Get 3 months of The Spectator for just £3. Go to spectator.co.uk/trial.
Hello and welcome to the Edition podcast from The Spectator, where each week we shed a little light on the thought process behind putting the world's oldest weekly magazine to bed. I'm Laura Prendergast, The Spectator's executive editor.
And I'm William Moore, The Spectator's features editor. This week, why Trump is stronger than ever, we meet some of the MAGA mega fans, and how techno-optimism became fashionable.
So, Will, this week's cover is Freddie Gray looking at what I think was probably an inevitable subject for us this week, Donald Trump. Can you talk us through a little bit about how the idea came about?
Well, the headline on the piece is Don Almighty, and it's Freddie Gray on Trump's lucky streak. And obviously the main peg for the piece is the failed assassination attempt on Donald Trump. And the result of that is that his supporters, his diehard supporters, more now than ever view him as America's chosen one. And in addition to that, he's had an extremely lucky week in many other ways. You know, Joe Biden's candidacy has been falling apart since his performance at the first presidential debate last month. He's now polling ahead. Trump, that is now polling ahead in all battleground states. So it does seem like things are very much now in Donald Trump's favor for storming the 2024 election. So we asked our brilliant cover artist, Morten Moreland, to do an image which would capture this moment. And I think he's done a complete terrific job. I know you're a particular fan of this cover, aren't you, Laura?
Yeah, well, we've depicted him as a kind of, obviously, tongue-in-cheek Byzantine saint. There are just some very funny details. He's got these putti either side of him with ears for their wings, and he's holding J.D. Vance. It's kind of, I guess, it's a Madonna and Child, but he's holding J.D. Vance, who's wrapped up in his long red tie. It's just, I don't know, I think it somehow captures a sense of what slight madness that's going on in America right now.
Yeah, well, there's also a particular religious theme to the whole thing, obviously, but that really does seem like it captures the moment, because there is this fervor that we're seeing out of the Republican National Convention. A lot of Trump supporters are acting as if he is blessed by the Almighty himself. I mean, because he was so lucky in his near miss on Saturday night.
So we've been joined by Freddie Gray, our deputy editor, and Amber Duke, Washington editor at the Spectator World. I started by asking Freddie about what the narrative shift has been around this failed assassination attempt on Donald Trump.
Well, it looks very much that way at the moment. And I think even the most kind of ardent non-believer in Donald Trump and Jesus Christ would have to admit that there is something supernaturally strange about the run of luck that Donald Trump has had. Obviously, the bullet missing, his head tilting at that very moment, fraction of a second, it's an extraordinary escape. That's one thing. But there are other things that are just falling into place at the right time, such as in the classified documents case being kind of kicked down the road now because it will be appealed. But he seems to have had a major legal win there on Monday. And Joe Biden's very dramatic implosion. He's been in decline for some time, but it seems to be getting worse. The Democrats are in terrible state. And now Donald Trump is ahead in all of the swing states and is looking at electoral victory. Some people are saying landslide. I think that's a bit carried away. And of course, we should be very careful about getting carried away, because only a fool would say that Donald Trump is now going to win the election, because American politics is very polarized. Sympathy for him about the assassination may vanish very quickly. And if anybody has the kind of personality to destroy public sympathy, it's Donald Trump.
But I mean, as you say in your piece, what Americans across the kind of whole political spectrum like is a warrior. And you say that Trump has sort of kind of shown himself to be that. Do you think that will help him win over voters who are perhaps undecided?
I think so, yes. And you've already seen, you know, people like Elon Musk, the richest man in the world, have gone from sort of occasional hints of Trump support to full-blown endorsements. Bill Ackman, a longtime Democrat, has also pledged his support now very openly. He's also a billionaire. And there does seem to be a lot of people, just looking from social media and so on, the polling's not yet clear, but that do think actually what Donald Trump did on Saturday evening was pretty extraordinary. And whatever one thinks of him, it's hard to deny that it was an extraordinary response to a terrifying situation.
Amber, you're joining this podcast from Milwaukee at the Republican National Convention. I wonder, could you start by giving our listeners a sense of the mood in Milwaukee and some of the conversations you've been having at the convention with Trump supporters and important Republican figures? I mean, what is the reaction been from the party to this extraordinary week that Trump has had?
Yeah, it's interesting. I've talked to quite a few party leaders, members of the RNC, delegates, people who work with Trump, either on the campaign or in some sort of external capacity. And the general consensus is that this convention feels really different from past conventions because, one, there's a significant amount of party unity around the nominee, and two, things have just been coming up Trump in an unbelievable fashion over the past week or two. And it almost feels like people are celebrating here. Like this is more of a party than it is an official party function. Everyone's in a good mood. Everyone's excited. And there is also a recognition, of course, as Freddie said, that people don't want to get their hopes up too high. And they want to make sure that the Trump campaign and Republicans down the ballot are still doing what they need to do to make sure that those leads don't evaporate, to make sure that they're not resting on their laurels. But yeah, the mood is really positive.
Freddie, this week we also had the announcement that J.D. Vance will be Trump's running mate. Mm. What did you make of that? Kate Andrews writes a sidebar to your piece, and she says that J.D. Vance, despite having called Trump America's Hitler, is actually more MAGA than Trump.
Well, I think it tells us that the MAGA movement and Trump are in a very confident mood. I think that if Biden was ahead in the polls, Trump may have been bullied by sort of the people running his campaign or donors and so on into picking someone else, someone more strategic. Names often mentioned, Nikki Haley would sort of help Trump appeal to people who don't like Trump but would vote Republican. I think J.D. Vance, because he is potentially the inheritor of the Trump movement after Trump, he's only 39, Trump is 78, it's an expression of confidence that Trumpism is the movement of the future, not just a sort of freakish political moment. I also think it's a more intelligent strategic choice for this election than perhaps some people have acknowledged, because Vance, although he's from Ohio, which is probably going to be a Republican state, Republican win in November anyway, he does represent the Rust Belt states in terms of who he is. He's a Appalachian working class boy who had a very tough upbringing, who's converted to Catholicism. All these things, I think, will help him appeal to people in Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, these states that are going to be really crucial in the election. So I do think it's quite smart.
And Kate makes the point in her piece that his journey sort of shows what Trump wants to show, which is a Trump naysayer to MAGA enthusiasts. So is he trying to kind of convince other people to go on the same journey?
Yeah, well, I just think that Vance is a sort of peculiar opposite to Trump, even though they're in the same place politically now. You know, Trump grew up rich, Vance grew up poor, Vance writes his own books, Donald Trump obviously doesn't. and they are these sort of interesting, there's an interesting pair. And I would say that even though, you know, I think Vance is a very interesting figure, and I think there's a lot of British press just getting very carried away with the democratic rhetoric that he's a far-right extremist. But I would say that he is a little bit dull, I think. And I think that that is one of the reasons why Donald Trump chose him, because Donald Trump would not like to be out-charismed on any front. And he likes the name, that's the other thing. Because it sounds a bit like Pence. And I think Trump was always very excited by the assonance of Trump-Pence. And Trump-Vance is pretty much the same thing.
It's what did Vivek in, wasn't it? It was having a long...
He was not going to have Ramaswamy on there.
Yeah. Yeah. Amber, how has the announcement of Trump's running mate, J.D. Vance, how's that gone down at the RNC? What's the reaction been?
It was pretty muted, actually. So the announcement came as a bit of a surprise. Most people were anticipating that Trump would actually come in person to the convention on Monday night, the first night, and make his VP selection there. But then about 30 minutes before we expected the announcement, he just put it out on Truth Social, which we should learn to expect the unexpected at this point with Trump. But it was Mike Lee, Senator Mike Lee, who happened to be the next up at the microphone to announce his state's delegates going for Donald Trump right after this announcement was made. He mentioned you know, Trump's newly announced running mate, J.D. Vance, and nobody reacted much at all. And I think what this tells us and what is important to remember is that J.D. Vance is not someone with super high name ID outside of Ohio. He is not really a known quantity. People who have heard of him just know him as an author. They don't really know much about his political stances outside of maybe they've heard that he's MAGA from the media. But so that's why people were really excited to hear his address Wednesday evening, because for many of them, it was the first time that they really got to hear who he is.
And Fred, just finally, in your piece, you say that in the wake of the shooting, Trump has begun to sound, and you say, believe it or not, both graceful and magnanimous.
Yes.
How long can that last? And do you think it's sort of plausible?
Well, my perverse theory is that it actually doesn't help Trump to be magnanimous and nice. I think there's a lot of sort of cant about he could become this unifying figure and so on. But I think Trump is tone deaf when it comes to kind of gushing sentimentality. I always think, I mentioned in the piece, of this bit he gave when he had some good economic news to announce when the Black Lives Matter riots were breaking out all over America. And he said that he imagined George Floyd, who'd obviously recently died, would be looking down. George would be looking down on us and thinking, what great news this is. And so he's, and you know, to say that didn't go down well is an understatement. People don't really expect Trump to be this kindly, avuncular, Gandhi figure that he's sort of making a few noises recently that he has been. So I think there is a danger for Trump that he does that.
I mean, after surviving something like that, I mean, could he genuinely be thinking, maybe I need to change my tack, or do you think it's implausible?
Well, I think, you know, and I don't mean this in a too anti-Trump sense. I think, you know, there are hints of a messianic complex there. Certainly when he had COVID in 2020, he started to think that it was somehow miraculous that he had been healed from a disease that most people recover from. You know, I think Americans are crying out for unity. The problem is, as Trump himself actually has already recognized, they're not going to want the kind of unity that Trump has to offer. The question is whether he is now so strong that the people who oppose him just cannot beat him.
Sorry, just finally, Amber, all of the news about the Trump's assassination attempt has, of course, taken a lot of the media focus away from the Democrats and their woes when it comes to the question of whether or not to stick with Joe Biden as their nominee before the Democrats convention next month. Do you think that the movement to replace Joe Biden as the Democratic nominee is losing momentum, or do you think that's still on the cards?
It's on pause with the convention, but it's going to come back. I mean, we've heard this week in reports that Democrat Senate candidate Adam Schiff, current congressman, was telling donors in private meetings that he believes if Biden is at the top of the ticket, that Democrats not only lose the presidency, but also lose the Senate, which would be obviously a huge deal. Republicans having both the House and the Senate and the presidency would give Trump, you know, a completely unchecked ability, essentially, to enact his agenda, which is a nightmare for the Democrats. And Jamie Harrison, the DNC chair, has been on X all week long arguing with people who have, you know, 400 followers about why the DNC is having a voice roll call vote to get Biden on the ballot in Ohio before August 7th, because they previously had a law that required the nominees to be on the ballot then. Of course, the Democratic convention falls after that date, but Ohio has since moved that deadline. So there's really no reason for the Democrats to be doing that roll call vote unless the DNC is just trying to push Biden through, get him on the ballot in Ohio as an argument against trying to replace him, pushing back against maybe some of the skeptics of Joe Biden. So there's a lot of fractures still in the Democrat Party right now that are going to definitely bubble up to the surface as soon as the attention is off of the Republican convention.
We've also got James Hill, our political correspondent in America at the moment. He's been in Milwaukee for the Republican National Convention. He's written for the magazine this week. He's been speaking to some of the MAGA fans, talking to them about how they think things have changed from 2016 to 2020 to 2024.
And James has kindly shared with us a couple of the interviews that informed his piece. The first one you'll be hearing from is Sharon Anderson, a delegate from Tennessee. And the second comes from something of a MAGA legend, Blake Marnell, a Californian Republican known as Brick Man. And exactly why he's known as that will become clear when you listen to the audio.
Where are you from?
I'm Sharon Anderson, and I'm from Tennessee, East Tennessee.
East Tennessee,
and I'm Trisha Hope from Texas.
Texas, okay. This year it was your first convention.
Yes.
What brought you along? What put you involved?
Donald Trump.
Donald Trump,
yes.
Yeah.
I've got to back his policies and his goals for this country. We've got to get him in. I want to be a delegate to represent the people of our state.
Why? What is it about Donald Trump that appeals so much?
His leadership. The fact that he is a leader. He is not somebody that is led. He leads. And his strength and his policies and his goals for this country. I agree with them for myself, my children, my grandchildren, future generations. And we're in such a perilous time, you know, such a perilous time of where the country can be lost any minute.
I was going to say, what happens to you if Trump doesn't win in November? What happens to America?
We'll lose it. We're already at the edge of losing it now. We'll lose it.
And what do you think are going to be the big issues in the next 4 months dominating this campaign?
The border.
The border, yeah.
The border is the biggest issue, in my opinion. The wars.
Yeah.
The economy.
Yeah.
The crime rates. Those are the biggest things for me. Job, you know, bringing jobs back to America.
How's the convention been so far? What are your takeaways from the first 2 days?
It's very exciting.
Yeah.
It's very uplifting. Everybody's stoked.
Yeah.
Everybody's ready to see Donald Trump go into office. We're all ready, and it's going to happen.
And what are you hoping he's going to say on Thursday when he makes the speech?
I think we may see a little bit different Donald Trump,
yeah,
because of the ordeal and near tragedy that happened Saturday. He may be a little subdued, because who wouldn't be? You know, after almost suffering death. But hopefully he will stay on topic. He always does. And so hopefully he'll stay on topic and he'll continue with his endeavor.
Yeah, can I just ask about your hats as well? They're homemade.
Yes.
What's the story behind them?
You won't see but one of these.
I love that. I bought one of those bobbleheads for my friend in London. Yeah, massive Donald Trump fan. And what's the thing on the sides?
Oh, ears.
Donkey.
Yes.
Obviously.
She has mules.
Yeah,
mules.
I have mules.
So you were in Washington in 2019?
I was in Washington, and I was going to be going to Washington and then taking a trip to Pennsylvania with my father. And I'd already been used to, like, wearing a Make America Great Again hat in public in San Diego just to make leftists really angry. And I'm thinking, if I'm going to go to the swamp in D.C., I need to up my game. Okay, I need to do something that's really over the top to really get people stirred up. And I'm thinking, well, what could I do? I could wear a shirt about tax cuts because President Trump had just cut taxes. And then I said, nah, that's not going to work. And I had this inspirational thought to look up wall suit on a search engine. And then this was available. And because you are from England, I can now talk about this suit and it's true. I will talk about it in just a moment, but what it was supposed to signify is the border wall. Support for President Trump's policies on the southern border to build a barrier to reduce illegal aliens crossing over the United States. This suit is actually an off-the-rack suit from England. You would probably recognize it as a stag suit. You would actually call it fancy dress. And in America, it's just a costume. So, you know, I have a little bit of inside information on that. So most people here don't realize that that's what it is. So that's all it is. And it just happened to be in a pattern that had some political significance here in the United States. So I bought that to wear so in the last 2 days of my vacation, I could go back to D.C. and trigger leftists. The day before I left on my vacation, President Trump announced a rally in Pennsylvania that was only 120 miles away from where I was, and it was on the last 2 days. So I'm just like, I got to go to that rally. And I went to that rally, and I got in the front row because I got there early. I'd been to two rallies before that, so I kind of knew when you had to get there to be early. And I got in the front row, and then midway through his address, he saw me in the crowd, and he just said, look at that guy. Look at that suit. Get him up here. Get him up here. So he called me up on stage. I go up on stage. I shake his hand. Crowd goes wild. And, you know, from that moment on, I'm brick suit. You know, when the president calls you up on stage wearing a brick suit, you're just brick suit now. You can't just like, you know, maybe I'll just be like seersucker suit or, you know, like blue blazer or something like that. You're just stuck as brick suit.
Have others followed you buying other brick suits? Are there other knockoffs? Is you following your example?
Well, there is one person who did, but not many, because the thing is these are out of production by 5 years when it started. So the only thing left was a bunch of residual inventory, and those got snapped up. And I bought four of them just to be safe, so I'd always have a supply because I knew I would never find them again.
And how do you think Trump and his second term, if he gets elected, will differ from the first term?
You know, I think Trump in his second term is going to be free to pursue the things that are correct without fear of moderating his policies to maintain re-election. You know, as it's going to be a four-year, I'm in office, I got 4 years to get it done, and they're just going to start checking out the boxes and getting it done as quickly as possible. I think it'll be, he's going to have the benefit of having been president once before, not be coming in from the first time. He's certainly learned from that prior, and I think we're just going to see a much more rapid implementation of the policies.
You think he'll actually build the wall second term?
Well, he almost finished it. And remember, for those who, you know, in England, we're not talking about a physical barrier coast to coast for all of America. We're talking about a system of border barriers, which is actually a fence that is designed to reduce and impede the flow of people and drugs into the United States, not eliminate. It's just designed to make it harder. And, you know, if you just keep a little bit of drugs from coming in, we have 100,000 people per year dying of fentanyl overdoses in our country. The bulk of that comes across our southern border. So interdicting anything you can is saving lives. And making it less easy for people to cross the border is also saving lives, because the toll in human trafficking, particularly on females who are crossing the border, is horrible. And let's not even talk about children, because that's too depressing.
Sure. And how's your convention gone so far? Are you enjoying it? It's your first convention.
My first convention, I'm absolutely enjoying it.
Thank you. Yeah. Are you here as a delegate or just an attendee?
I am a delegate from the state of California.
That's a delegate from the state of California. What are your plans for the next 2 days?
You know, I just want to tell as many people as I can about the problems we're having in California with unchecked immigration.
Yeah.
The fuel prices are excessive. Housing is through the roof. And, you know, some of the big drivers of that are just there are so many non-citizens living in our state because we are a sanctuary state.
Well, thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it. Enjoy your convention.
All right, take care.
Can you get him up here? Get him up here. Come on. Look at this guy.
Laura, what other pieces did you enjoy from the magazine this week?
There's a great notebook this week from Sir David Hempelman-Adams, who actually joined us on Table Talk, our food and drink podcast. He attempted to fly a hydrogen balloon across the Atlantic from America's side over to France. But as he says in his piece, it didn't quite all go to plan. So I would recommend that. And we can actually hear from David here.
We took off from Presque Isle, a small town in northern Maine, which is known for snow and potatoes. The first ever Atlantic balloon crossing took off from here in 1978, successfully landed in France. Our predicted track showed us landing at the same destination. Using powerful computers, our teams of meteorologists had our high splits worked out, showing the altitude we would have to fly in each part of the crossing to get us into a field in France. The weathermen in 1978 just put a finger in the ear and said, "Bon voyage." Our team worked through the night to get the balloon inflated. It looked magnificent on the launch site, floodlit in the night sky. The three of us would be sleeping on the floor of the basket in a space no bigger than a kitchen table. We slowly climbed into the night sky to the strains of the Star Spangled Banner and immediately found the actual weather was not as forecast. "How can they get it so wrong so quickly?" I thought.
Will, what about you? What did you enjoy?
I really enjoyed Gus Carter's piece about Wimpy Bars. And I think it's a bit of a scoop, actually, that we all heard the other week that the Liberal Democrats in the election campaign targeted places which had a Gale's Bakery, the for listeners who don't know, extremely overpriced, very fancy bakery. In contrast, Gus has discovered that the Reform UK party targeted constituencies which had a wimpy bar. So what does that tell us about modern Britain, about wimpy bars? Well, Gus explains all in, I think, an extremely interesting piece. Well, the final piece we're going to talk about in a little bit more detail is by Max Jeffrey. And he writes in this week's magazine about the New Solutions, which is a trio of ideologies that rich, tech-savvy geeks, as he calls them, have adopted as philosophies to try to make the world a better place. And they have rather fancy names, techno-optimism, effective altruism, and effective accelerationism. So what on earth does all that mean, you might well ask? Well, Max joined us on the podcast to discuss, along with Anders Sandberg, who is an effective altruist and also a senior research fellow at Oxford.
Yeah, I've tried to group them together in something that I've called the New Solutions. And as you say, they're all new ideas that are becoming popular, particularly with young people and recent graduates, about how to better civilization. And they tend to center around technological progress. So, for example, effective accelerationism, or some people would call it E/AC or EAC for short, is about society developing technology as fast as it can and saying that that is the only way that we can have a kind of prosperous future. You then have, as you said, effective altruism, which is all about the best way to improve society is to give as much money away as you can, as effectively as you can. And then you have techno-optimism, which is saying the best way to improve society is through technological progress. So they're all kind of similar-ish ideas, but with slightly different tints on them. And they've kind of been fermented at universities, at academic institutions, like the one that Anders was a part of, the Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford. And they're becoming increasingly popular in Silicon Valley, in London's tech scene, and at universities like Oxford, Cambridge, and American ones like Harvard and Stanford.
And now they've got their own clubs even, don't they, in London?
Yeah, so that was the way into this piece, which is a new club called Future House, which is in Hackney, which calls itself London's Techno-Optimist Members Club. And it's where groups of techno-optimists go and meet together, and they kind of discuss what projects they're working on. So whether that's private projects, so they've got their own startup, it's developing in the AI space or something like that, or they just go to discuss this general idea of how technology can make the world a better place. It's a really interesting members club. It's not as formal as stuffy as your regular ones that you might get around kind of the Spectator offices this area of London, but they've got kind of a robot dog imported from China, a sign on the wall that says just fucking build something. They've got a bath that they fill during parties with ice and bottled beers, a bed for people to take naps in. So it's an interesting place.
Anders, thank you very much for coming on the podcast today. Jumping right in, the philosopher William McCaskill fermented the concept of effective altruism while you were both working at the Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford. Would you consider yourself an adherent effective altruist?
I usually quit that I'm not particularly effective. But it's true. It kind of grew up around me. So I think Will was just a student when he was having excited conversations during tutorials in the office next to mine. I didn't pay any attention. I just kept on writing about nuclear holocaust and the ways various technologies could go badly wrong. And then I started noticing that there was excited talk about charity around the office. And before I knew it, there was organizations popping up and I was hearing really interesting arguments that maybe we're doing something wrong when trying to make the world a better place. We donate to charity and maybe we take a look at how much are we wasting on admin and is the boss driving around fast cars with loose women and too much drugs? Maybe that's not a good charity. But we rarely ask, well, the money they actually hand out, does it go to something useful? It turns out that it can be thousands of times difference in how effective it saves lives. So if you just got a slightly more money to something more effective, you could totally make up for other things. So that got us interested, because if there are big inefficiencies in the world, why aren't they getting fixed? And that was really the start of effective altruism. So I've been sitting a little bit on the sidelines and been chatting with a lot of people involved and trying to think very big picture about how do you fix the world.
Would you also describe yourself as a techno-optimist as well? Are you optimistic about the future of
very
technological
much.
Innovation?
I'm so much of a techno-optimist that I spend a lot of time thinking about ways technology can totally destroy the world. So in the 90s, I was of Extropia's mailing list. I still regard myself as a transhumanist, thinking that, yeah, we should totally use technology to transcend human limitations. But of course, if you think the future could become radically better through technology, But honestly, you should think that maybe we could foul it up and radically make the future really worse. So that got me and Nick Bostrom thinking quite hard about the ways we could mess up the world, which has led to a lot of research which is decidedly gloomy about existential risk and trying to fix that. So in this heady mix of, yay, technology is going to fix everything, we also have us doomers saying, yeah, and if we do it wrong, we're totally going to wipe out our species. We better do it right. This is, of course, not something the accelerationists like to hear. They say, no, you fuddy-duddies. We should have unregulated technology. What could possibly go wrong with genetic engineering and AI?
Well, Max, when it comes to these different different ideologies, the three that you mentioned in your piece, as highlighted by Anders there, there's actually sometimes a bit of tension between these different ideas, aren't they? I wonder, could you explain that a little bit more for our listeners? And perhaps also explain what are some of the politics that also go on behind these ideologies? Are the people involved, do they tend to be left-wing? Do they tend to be right-wing?
Yeah, I think the division seemed to be formed around artificial intelligence. So effective altruism, if you're talking about how can we save the most number of lives, because I think that's kind of the basic idea behind it, you then get into, as Anders says, well, we then need to mitigate existential risks. So things like pandemics, we should put more money into making sure that there are pandemics, therefore people won't die. And we should also be careful about how we're developing artificial intelligence, because again, if that wipes out the species, that's a bad thing. So you have that on one side, and then some of the other ideologies, like effective accelerationists, they'll say, no, we need to build things as fast as we can. That's the only way that our society stays alive. And so then you have, over artificial intelligence, this tension where the effective altruists say, we need to be careful, and the accelerationists are saying, let's go as fast as we can. So even though these ideas kind of, they're mixing among the same groups of people in similar institutions and organizations, that's where the tension really built. And that's then kind of fed down the line into kind of micro disputes between, say, members clubs. So you have at Future House, I went to an event there, and you kind of hear people say, people are kind of slagging off in quiet corners, the effective altruists. And you also then have other members clubs that are popping up around London, different organizations. There's one called Pelican House, one called the Autonomy Institute, another place called Newspeak House that I write about. Those ones have a slightly left-wing tinge to it, whereas Future House has a right-wing tinge to it. And I guess that kind of comes with the territory. You're talking about technological development, capitalism, saying that's a good thing. And so you get all these kind of ideological and political tensions that play into these different
There's also been a bit of scandal involved with some of these movements, hasn't there?
Yeah, I mean, there's scandal at the very top of effective altruism, I think, right at the end, which is the story that many people will be familiar with Sam Bankman-Fried. So he was probably the most famous effective altruist. He ran a company called FTX, which was a cryptocurrency exchange. People tried to withdraw their money and it ended up that there were billions of dollars missing. So he was saying that he was giving money to all these great causes when really actually he was hurting a lot of his own customers. He's now been sentenced to a couple of decades in prison.
Yeah.
And there's also been smaller issues, I think, between some of the, well, definitely smaller issues between some of the members clubs in London. Some of the guys at Future House don't particularly like the guys at Newspeak House. The guys at Newspeak House are a little quieter about their disagreements with the guys at Future House, but they see them as a bit too right-wing, I think.
Yeah. And what's your view on some of these feuds that Max is drawing attention to, and also the scandal involving Sam Bankman-Fried? Have they dragged effective altruism through the mud somewhat?
Well, at least publicly, I think many people unfortunately got this association between that horrible scandal and EA. And when you're dealing with charity, your reputation is really important. Now, the good news is, of course, yeah, but many people still realize that no matter what I call myself, I should be trying to effectively make the world a better place. But that kind of disputes between different groups, I'm old enough to remember all the fractionalists among my friends in the transhumanist movement. And I'm old enough to hear stories from parents about the 1968 movement. Of course, when you get new movements, people immediately create cliques and start doing silly tribalism. And I think life is too short to spend too much time on that. But many younger people find it very exciting and think it really matters. After a while, you realize, nah, actually, you should build something. And that might be a company, or it might be an organization, or it might just be really good ideas. I think there are, however, some deep and really hot issues. It's not just should we press some gas pedal or try to brake or steer the technological progress. That's basically one of the big battles. You see it especially about AI. But you might also start talking about, do we want to have a diversity of experimentation to try a lot of things, or do we need to have the best possible strategy? So I'm fond of the libertarian thinker Virginia Postrel, and in her book, The Future and Its Enemies, she distinguishes between the dynamist and the statists. And the dynamist says, the future looks pretty bright. Let 1,000 flowers bloom and let's do the best thing. Let's experiment. While the statist says, oh, the future looks dangerous. We need either technocrats, or you go full reactionary and say, no, let's retreat to the good old times. And our main point was, this is actually the new political spectrum. It's not left and right. You can totally find left-wing and right-wing statists, just like you can find left-wing and right-wing dynamists. But you have this tension about, how do you see the future? How good is it? And how big are the risks? Are the potholes in the road, or are you even a real precipice you could drive over if you're not careful?
Max, just finally, what argument, if any, did you find most convincing when you were having these conversations for writing this piece? Have you been won over by any of the arguments for these new solutions?
Well, it's funny. I think you speak to a lot of effective altruists, and they say that they found the ideas of, despite what happened with Sam Bankman-Fried, still completely convincing. I personally kind of find them, when I looked into the movement, you kind of see that it's very centralized. It's run by a big organization called the Center for Effective Altruism that distributes money. There have been some troubles and disagreements about the way that that's run. I think that the effective accelerationists seem like the funnest bunch and the guys who I thought were most interesting. They don't seem to take themselves often too seriously. A lot of it's a Twitter movement, I think. So there's a lot of trolling. You try and ask someone who, you speak to some of them and they say, I can't believe you're even asking about this. This isn't a real thing. You're making it up. It's just a meme. And they're quite a fun bunch. So they're probably the guys I got on with the most.
Well, just before we finish up, I might just recommend readers and listeners turn to the competition page this week, because there's a brilliant competition and our readers have submitted their entries to it, in which they've been asked to come up with a passage in which Gulliver travels to a Taylor Swift concert and recounts his impressions. And there are some brilliant entries, so I would recommend that to listeners as well. And that's everything this week. As ever, you can pick up the magazine to read everything we've discussed, including that competition page. I'm Laura Prendergast.
And I'm William Moore. And we do hope you'll join us again next week.